Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com, broadcasting from the studios of WORT-FM in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the president's stinging rebuke of the economic plans being offered up by Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, which Obama described as fantasies. Economist Bruce Bartlett, who served as a domestic policy advisor to Ronald Reagan and as a deputy assistant for economic policy in the Treasury Department during the George H.W. Bush administration, joins us to discuss the absurdity of Trump's economic plan that would add $9.6 trillion to the deficit in a decade, while Cruz's plan would add $8.5 trillion over the same period. We will also discuss a prescient article Bruce Bartlett wrote for Politico last July, A Moderate Republican's Case for Trump, Only Trump Can Make the GOP Sane Again, by losing in a landslide to Hillary Clinton. Then Matthew Rothschild joins us in the studio. He is the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign and the former editor of The Progressive magazine, and we will discuss his efforts to get money out of politics in Wisconsin, where Governor Scott Walker has benefited greatly from outside billionaire money that has financed a reactionary agenda in the state. We will also discuss the presidential race now increasingly narrowing to a Clinton-Trump face-off that, in this year of the outsider, could see Donald Trump elected as the next president of the United States. Then finally, historian Alfred McCoy joins us in the studio to discuss President Obama's pivot to Asia and the strategy that underlies it and the possibility of the U.S. and China drifting into a new Cold War. A Tom Dispatch regular, Alfred McCoy holds the Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin and is the author of Policing America's Empire, The United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State, and a forthcoming book on U.S. global power, Ending the American Empire. And joining us now is Bruce Bartlett, who is a columnist for the Fiscal Times and Tax Notes and also contributes a weekly post to the economics blog at the New York Times and was previously a columnist for Forbes magazine. He served on the congressional staffs of Congressman Ron Paul and Jack Kemp and is executive director of the Joint Economic Committee of Congress and a senior domestic policy analyst in the Reagan White House and as deputy assistant secretary of economic policy at the Treasury Department during the George H.W. Bush administration. He's the author of 7 books, including the New York Times bestseller, Imposter, How George W. Bush Bankrupted America and Betrayed the Reagan Legacy, and his latest book is Benefit and the Burden. And he had an article last July at Politico, A Moderate Republican's Case for Trump, Only Trump Can Make the GOP Sane Again, by losing in a landslide to Hillary Clinton. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bruce Bartlett.
Happy to be here.
And let's start out with President Obama's interview with the New York Times, where he really had some very strong words about the economic plans of the Republicans vying to succeed him, particularly Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, suggesting that their economic platforms were, in fact, not based on any known economic theories. They are fantasy. So what's your response?
Well, he's exactly correct about that. I think Republicans live in a fantasy world where it's always 1980, where hyperinflation is right around the corner and the Fed must tighten. Maybe we should go back to a gold standard where tax rates are high and need to be cut, and where government regulation is too strong. And all these policies that that Ronald Reagan implemented and quite successfully, they think must be re-implemented every year, forever, regardless of the circumstances. And I think that's just nonsense. It's in fact crazy. I think what you have to do is look at economic circumstances as they are today, not through some rose-colored glasses or whatever the opposite of rose-colored glasses is, and devise policies that are based on analysis and on those current circumstances. And on that basis, I think the Republican policies are almost entirely wrong.
Well, given that the mantra has been for so long about the sky is falling because of the deficits, according to the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center, Donald Trump's economic plans would add $9.5 trillion over a decade to the deficit, and Ted Cruz's plans would add $8.6 trillion to the deficit over the decade. So it may be fantasy, but is it Is it dishonest? Do you think either of those two know better?
That's a really good question. It's hard to tell. But I think Republicans quite often, in fact almost all of them, have the view that deficits can only arise from one cause, which is higher spending. Deficits never result from lower revenues. Therefore, you can cut taxes all you want, as much as you want, and still claim that you are being fiscally responsible. Again, this is I'm not defending this. It's a point of view that is, in fact, crazy, but it is one that is very, very widely held in, among Republicans.
So yesterday, of course, Donald Trump had his big foreign policy speech, which was widely dismissed as a series of kind of campaign platform cliches, no substance, no backup. And it seems like President Obama coming out today criticizing the economic plans of the two leading Republican rivals. Is this a sort of know-nothing period we're entering into? I mean, apropos of your article in last July in Politico, it certainly got my attention and a lot of other people's attention, the idea that making a moderate Republican's case for Trump, only Trump can make the GOP sane again by losing in a landslide to Hillary Clinton. That's shaping up, at least in terms of the competition. It does look more and more like a Trump-Clinton competition.
Oh, I don't think there's any question about that. Keep in mind that in the United States, we really did have an honest-to-God, know-nothing party, which existed between the time the Whig Party expired, which in many ways I think the Republican Party is in the same situation that the Whigs were then. And then you had this interregnum in which you had the crazy know-nothing party, and then from the ashes, the modern Republican Party emerged. And perhaps under a best-case scenario, something like that will happen, where a new revitalized, I don't even necessarily call it a Republican Party, but a conservative party, a conservative alternative to the Democratic Party, will emerge that is free of a lot of the craziness and bigotry and racism and xenophobia and other very unattractive elements of the Republican coalition that, frankly, Donald Trump panders to.
So who would end up with the rump? Would the Republican Party be the rump controlled by the Tea Party, or would the people that you're talking about, the traditional Republicans, reasserting themselves, would they have to rebrand themselves, or could they take the party?
It's impossible to say. It's just too early. One of the theories that I've heard people talking about in terms of how the Republican establishment will respond to Trump is to literally run another Republican third party against him. I mean, this is crazy, but of course it did in fact happen in our history. In 1860, the Democratic Party actually ran two separate candidates for president, and one Democrat ran some of the states and another Democrat ran in other states. And of course they divided the vote, and that's what elected Abraham Lincoln. And perhaps something similar to that will happen this year. I don't know.
But it seems to me that the problem is in the primary system itself, that on the Republican side, you've got to run a right-wing gauntlet that moves further and further to the right. And on the Democratic side, you've got to run a left-wing gauntlet that moves further and further to the left. And then you've got to, you know, suddenly bounce back to the center for the general. And you can see how difficult it's going to be for Trump, and even Cruz, who just picked Carly Fiorina for his running mate. He had to eat his words about stuff. I mean, she had to eat her words about what she'd said about him only months ago, being an opportunist who'd say anything. So, you know, in this digital age of tweeting and everything is on the record, it seems to me pretty hard to figure out how we can moderate our politics in this country unless something's done about the primary system.
That's perhaps true, but I would also note that the problem is vastly worse in the Republican Party. Although it's true that there is a growing and aggressive left-wing progressive element in the Democratic Party that supported Bernie Sanders, I don't see any real evidence that this had any effect whatsoever on Hillary Clinton's campaign. I can't think of any position offhand on which she moved to the left from where she was to counter the Sanders challenge. So basically, she's still in pretty good shape, I think, to run a general election campaign, whereas somebody like Trump or Cruz is going to have to, you know, do a backflip and basically say the opposite of everything they've been saying for the past year.
And just in closing then, Bruce Bartlett, what's your reading on the down ballot disaster that's being predicted? And clearly it's got people like Paul Ryan worried. He's been, his colleagues have been beating the door down saying, what are we going to do about Trump? He's suggested he's not going to run. I'm not sure that the White Knight scenario could work out at this convention in Cleveland. But what's your assessment of the down ticket damage that Trump would do to the Republican Party?
Well, I think what the Republican establishment is mainly concerned about is that a lot of Republicans will not be able to vote for Trump, and rather than go and vote for, say, Hillary and then vote Republicans for all the other races, they'll simply stay home on Election Day. And I think that's their deepest fear, because then they're losing not only the White House, but they're potentially losing the Senate and possibly even the House of Representatives at the same time. So that's why this idea of running a third-party Republican isn't quite as crazy as it sounds, because it gives those people who will not vote for Trump a reason to go to the polls, and hopefully they will vote for whoever this third-party candidate is, and for the regular Republican down ticket. So that's what makes sense of that otherwise crazy strategy.
Well, Bruce Bartlett, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Bruce Bartlett, who's a columnist for the Fiscal Times and Tax Notes, and also contributes a weekly post to the economics blog at the New York Times, and was previously a columnist for Forbes magazine. He served on the congressional staffs of Ron Paul and Jack Kemp, and as a executive director of the Joint Economic Committee of Congress and a senior domestic policy advisor, analyst in the Reagan White House, and a deputy assistant secretary for economic policy in the Treasury Department during the George H.W. Bush administration. And he's the author of 7 books, including the New York Times bestseller, Imposter, How George W. Bush Bankrupted America and Betrayed the Reagan Legacy. And his latest book is Benefit and the Burden. And he had an article last July at Politico, A Moderate Republican's Case for Trump. Only Trump can make the GOP be sane again by losing in a landslide to Hillary Clinton. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with the former editor of The Progressive magazine talking about the possibility of a Trump presidency.
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us in the studio of WORT-FM in Madison, Wisconsin, is Matthew Rothschild, who is the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign and previously the senior editor of the Progressive magazine. He's one of the leading voices for peace and social justice in this country and the author of You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Rothschild.
Hey, Ian, it's great to see you finally, to meet you after being on your show and hearing that beautiful voice of yours for years, and now I get to see the beautiful face.
Well, it's interesting, though. This is a progressive moment in the sense that Bernie Sanders has introduced a whole dialogue that has been sort of shut out of our politics. You know, politics have been extremely constipated and narrow and largely focused on the right. So he's broadened the spectrum a little bit and pushed it towards the left. But, of course, his main campaign theme has been getting money out of politics. And he basically saying that unless we get overturned Citizens United, there's not much point in doing anything else.
Yeah, he's really drawn attention to that. He's forced Hillary Clinton to pay attention to it. Both of them have vowed that they would have a litmus test for a Supreme Court nominee. That litmus test wouldn't be about abortion rights. Actually, it would be about overturning Citizens United. And so they've really brought that front and center. And this movement to overturn Citizens United, to amend the U.S. Constitution, to proclaim finally that corporations aren't persons and money isn't speech, is gaining ground all over the country, and is actually gaining ground here in Wisconsin, even though we're facing all these reactionary politicians who've gotten elected. In now 72 villages, towns, cities, and a few counties in Wisconsin, the people have voted every time by overwhelming margins in favor of referendums to overturn Citizens United and to amend the Constitution. 11 more towns and cities voted just on April 5th to do that, and the margins were like 75%, 77%, 80%. It's popular everywhere you go. People understand that the system is rigged. And Bernie's been talking about it. Actually, in a weird way, Donald Trump has been talking about it, too. I mean, he talked about it in that first Republican debate, remember, with all those 13 candidates up there. He's saying, you know, I know these guys. I've written checks to them all, and they all answer my phone when I call. And even Hillary Clinton, I wrote her a check, and guess what? She sat in the front row of my wedding. And, you know, a lot of rich people give not for vanity's sake to get the first lady in the front row of their wedding, but because they want something from government. They want a tax subsidy. They want a contract. They want to grease the wheels. And so they do that with their money.
So are you in any way optimistic then that Citizens United could be overturned? That is what both Sanders and Clinton have said is their first priority.
I think it will be overturned, either by the Supreme Court with a different composition of the U.S. Supreme Court, or it will be overturned fundamentally with a constitutional amendment that I think will happen in the next 10 or 15 years. Because if we have any chance for a democracy here, we've got to get rid of Citizens United. But it's not just the Citizens United decision of 2010 that said corporations could dip into their treasury and spend unlimited amounts of money to elect this candidate or trash another one. There's 140 years of legal precedent that says corporations are persons. And that has to be overturned. And to really do that, we need to amend the Constitution. If we don't amend the Constitution, it's just going to be a question as to, you know, who dies on the Supreme Court and who's replaced and who's the president at that time. If we're going to fundamentally fix the problem, we really need to go the amendment route.
Well, I've always been struck how extraordinarily, what a great sort of black hole of historical memory there is in terms of the Supreme Court, in terms of the 1896 Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad decision that you just referenced there, that created this fiction that corporations are persons in law. In all of these hearings they have for Supreme Court justices, they ask them about abortion around the clock, but they never ask them whether they're corporatists, you know, where they stand on these issues. And frankly, it was very noticeable when Justice Scalia died, Dow Chemicals, who were facing a $1 billion fine, which they thought they wouldn't have to pay because of Scalia's vote, and suddenly when he died, they ponied up $1 billion. Doesn't that tell you something?
Well, it does. And Scalia's death has really thrown the right-wing mission kind of into panic, because the right wingers for the last 40 years were counting on a reactionary Supreme Court. The Roberts Court is a very corporatist court, to use your term. And now with Scalia gone, they don't have the majority. And if President Obama gets his nominee approved, which I think there's still a chance of, or if Bernie or Hillary get elected and they get their people on the court, we're going to have a liberal Supreme Court. And that will be one check on this corporate agenda.
So in the meantime, though, what you said that you're in favor of a constitutional amendment, that's a long haul, isn't it?
It's a long haul, but, you know, 16 people in 16 states have already voted statewide that they want to amend the Constitution. It's vastly popular across partisan grounds. Republicans, 80% think businesses have too much sway over our electoral system, and something like 75% of Republicans agree that these outside groups should be limited in and how much money they could spend, you know, trashing candidates and splashing mud all over our TV screens at election time. So, you know, the people are with us. There's a little chicken and egg problem, of course, that the politicians who get elected are getting elected under this dirty money system that we have. And how are we going to get them to vote for a constitutional amendment which will force them to get elected in a different way?
Right, but the dirty money system that you're talking about is enabled by the press, because all of these congresspeople and senators who have essentially become telemarketers, who spend most of their days asking rich people for money. They have these call centers at the RNC and the DNC, and they just go down this list and phone cold calling for money all day long, just about. That money then is turned over to the mainstream media in the form of television advertising. So my sense is that, you know, we've got to call out the mainstream media for their complicity in this. They are obviously benefiting and profiting from a broken political system.
Yeah, and we need to, you know, force them to open the public airwaves for free and take their profit motive out of the electoral system and out of this whole dirty political system. Les Moonves, head of CBS News, was cheering Donald Trump on because he knew that, you know, as long as Donald Trump was there, his ratings were going to go up. So that's a whole nother phenomenon that's been going on in this electoral system. But I've been at TV stations on election night, and the station managers, they're just kind of chortling about how much money they brought in during the election season. It's just a huge cash cow for these private corporations, and the airwaves are supposed to belong to us, the people, and instead they're being privatized, and that's part of the corruption of our whole political system and our electoral finance system.
So the other issue, though, Matthew, in terms of the work that you're doing here in Wisconsin and that's others are doing across the country and trying to overturn Citizens United to bring about a constitutional amendment and to, in general, get money out of politics, voters in, money out. MOVI is another group in California that I'm familiar with. So there's a lot of groups around the country that recognize this. And as you said, when you go around to talk to people in at the sort of local level, they all feel that way too. But isn't this tied into a bigger issue in terms of undoing the Reagan era canard that government is the problem? And Trump is showing you that people have really drunk that Kool-Aid. They hate the government. They don't trust politicians. There's every reason in the world not to, because they are all on the take. Well, but the system is what's corrupt and what's wrong. And it's simply put, doesn't it mean that the only way that we're going to ever restore democracy in this country is for people to empower themselves and recognize that it is their government, not somebody else's government, which it clearly is. This is the government of the oligarchs, the plutocrats, the big corporations. It's not the government of the people. But until the people reassert themselves, it will always be the way it is.
And that's been the beauty of the Bernie Sanders campaign, really, because he's talked about a government for all of us, for the average citizen, not for the top 1% or the oligarchs or the billionaire class, as he calls it. And when was the last time we heard discussion of the billionaire class in America so explicitly? So that's been one tremendous advantage that Bernie Sanders has brought. When was the last time we heard about redistribution of wealth and income blatantly, explicitly, out loud, which is what we need? So, but you're right. I mean, the ideology that has taken sway, and, you know, the old quote, ruling ideas are the ideas of the ruling class, is that everything private is good, everything public is bad. That's the ideology that has taken over our state here with Scott Walker, so that he's been attacking public sector workers, and then he's attacking public education. They're not even funding the public parks here in Wisconsin anymore. It's the idea that the private sector does everything well, and the government is some kind of tyranny, when in actual fact, a private corporation is a dictatorship. People are working in dictatorships 9 to 5.
But how do you come up with a kind of manifesto that gets people? I mean, for example, people that in social democracies, like the ones that Bernie Sanders talked about, the Scandinavian ones, and I'm originally from Australia where there is a social democracy, and it's, by the way, there's compulsory voting too, and that even the right wing, the last time that this government that just was replaced but still is a right wing government, when this character that just got booted out ran for prime minister, and it's called the Liberal Party, but it's really the Conservative Party. Do you know what his platform was? 6 months fully paid pregnancy leave for all Australian women and their significant others. You know, they call them de facto relationships. Can you imagine? The Democrats in this country could never run on a campaign like that. But the reason that the Conservatives ran on a campaign like that was that 90%+ of the people vote. So that's a place to start. And the other place to start, my sense, is that people have got to understand the simple concept of social democracy, which is you pay your taxes and you get your government services. We don't get anything for our taxes except Social Security and Medicaid, which is under assault. So for a country that's got a real bottom line practical streak in it, can't you make that case that you pay your taxes and you get your services? And God damn it, if they don't deliver your services, you kick them out.
Right. And that's the case I think Bernie was trying to make. And he does defend Medicare and Social Security. He understands that people like Medicare and Social Security, and he wants Medicare for all. And he wants to lower the age and increase the benefits of Social Security. He also did talk about paid maternity and paternity leave, paid family leave. And so he was really putting on the table, he's been putting on the table these really progressive, socially democratic principles that I think we need to get around. I mean, if we can't, you know, sell that, we can't sell popcorn in the movie theater.
Well, just in closing then, Matthew Rothschild, how do you see the, it's pretty clear, isn't it, that it's going to looking more and more like a Trump Clinton race. But on the other hand, you know, Bernie has brought in over 8 million voters and a lot of energy and a lot of optimism. And this is the younger generation he's brought in. And by logic, the younger generation are the ones that could inherit both either the Democratic Party or form a new party. So how do you see things shaping up?
Well, I haven't totally given up on Bernie's chances, but I do think I worry about this Trump-Clinton face-off because it's not the year for an establishment politician. Trump's not establishment. Bernie's not establishment. All the excitement is for these non-establishment politicians and Hillary, except for the fact that she'd be the first woman president, and that is a big exception. But other than that, she is a very establishment politician, and that suggests that there may be some problems, and some young people may not go along for the ride.
So what do we do?
I think we need mass movements outside of the narrow, and we saw how narrow the confines are of the Democratic Party, especially the leadership of the Democratic Party, and we've got to work from the outside in like you do for the $15 an hour movement. That's been a great success story, or the gay rights movement. Those have been huge success stories that weren't imprisoned in the Democratic Party.
Right, but basically you're saying that Hillary's deficiencies might be such that Trump could win. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I've always been afraid that there's a real possibility that Trump would not only get the Republican nomination, but would also get the White House. I do think that is a real possibility.
Well, on that cheery note, I thank you for joining us, Matthew Rothschild.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Matthew Rothschild, who's the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, and previously he was senior editor of the Progressive magazine and one of the leading voices for peace and social justice in this country, and is the author of You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back, joined in the studio by the historian Alfred McCoy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. We're broadcasting today from the studios of WORT-FM in Madison, Wisconsin. And joining me in the studio is Alfred McCoy, a Tom Dispatch regular who holds the Harrington Chair of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the editor of Endless Empire, Spain's Retreat, Europe's Eclipse, America's Decline, and the author of Policing America's Empire, The United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State. His forthcoming book on U.S. global power is Ending the American Empire. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alfred McCoy.
Thank you.
And, of course, in terms of your forthcoming book, just to touch on that, I've always thought that the great challenge in this country is whether or not the republic will survive the empire. So when you say the empire will end, or there's a way to end the empire, is that to say that you can save the republic?
That's been a tension that's been evident ever since the United States emerged on the global stage a little bit more than a century ago. Mark Twain and a number of Northeastern intellectuals were deeply concerned about the damage that the U.S. conquest of the Philippines and Puerto Rico and Guam were doing to the American Republic. And basically, Twain wrote a very insightful article, sort of a history of America written several centuries later. And he said, words I paraphrase, his grammar was classic, sort of Victorian age. But he said that America, having learned the ability to oppress others abroad, suffered the like at home. In other words, what we did to others abroad in this brutal pacification and subjugation of a foreign society created techniques that we brought homeward. And in essence, what Twain was saying is that there was a difficult choice for a rising society between democracy at home and empire abroad, and there's a constant tension between the two. And that tension is very much evident, I think, today as a kind of subtext in all the political debates over trade pacts and also the falling wages and the declining standard of middle-class living. People, once upon a time, actually, it just seems only like a year or two ago, the received wisdom was that trade pacts were a win-win for everybody. American industries and corporations got new markets. Americans got exports, which would create jobs. They got cheaper domestic goods. So it was win-win for everybody. And now we begin to realize, no, not so, that the globalization has its definite domestic costs. Yes, American multinational corporations expand their global reach, gain new markets. Profits go up. Executive salaries go up. But communities get hollowed up. People lose jobs. And the idea that they'll find better jobs or different jobs, we now realize that they find worse jobs. They fall from stable manufacturing jobs with benefits, union wages, pensions, and they fall into the service sector as, $8 an hour wage slaves. So there's a realization that there's a real contradiction between globalization, America's global reach, and domestic security and prosperity.
Well, I have to touch on, of course, yesterday's remarks by Donald Trump, where he outlined his foreign policy manifesto, which, of course, dealt with globalism. But it was essentially a kind of a dog's breakfast of all of his previous campaign stump. I can't even call them speeches because he talks in tweets as opposed to speeches. But essentially, there is a great alarm amongst the American foreign policy community about the possibility of him becoming president. And even though it's widely dismissed by both Republicans and Democrats as a possibility, I don't think it's something that you can overlook. I mean, we've had these sort of nativist outbursts in our history, have we not? And what would that do? I don't want to dwell on it, but how would you see a Trump presidency?
Well, let's hold back from that. If you don't mind, I could recast your question. What do I think of Trump's take on U.S. foreign policy, U.S. stature, geopolitical stature? And with Trump, as we've discovered, there's sometimes a kind of awkward germ of truth deep in that rhetoric that when he vocalizes his antagonism towards people from Mexico or talks about building the wall, he's addressing working class communities that have been hollowed out by this process of globalization that I just talked about, that are really suffering very badly, whose wages and lifestyles have fallen, whose life circumstances are rather stressed and strained. Okay, and in the same way, nobody's really thought about what Trump means when he talks about make America great again. The only guy that picked it up was my friend and editor Tom Engelhardt at Tom Dispatch. And he had a piece out a couple of days ago in which he said Trump is the only person on the American political stage that talks about America as a fallen power. Make America great again. It's not keep us great or, extend our greatness. It's, again, in other words, we've fallen. Trump is the only declinist, as we're called, I'm one of them, who's actually running for president, who recognized that American global power has receded. And so, his whole logic of recovery, of resurgence, of renewal, that's somebody speaking from a position of a fallen power, a declining power. And he's the only one that admits that. And right. So there is that, there's, and you know what? Amazing that for all the millions of words, billions of words that are spoken about Donald Trump, only Tom Engelhardt has picked up that fundamental fact, that fundamental truth about Trump. And he speaks to Americans, and Americans seem to know it. So Americans seem to feel it. So forget what the policy elites in Washington think. The American people think that we're in decline, that we have fallen.
Well, their lives are in decline in terms of economics, by and large. That's a reality. But is there the U.S. in decline necessarily a bad thing? I mean, and particularly the idea that you could bring it back with more defense spending, which seems to be doubling down on a path to nowhere.
Are we in decline? Clearly. After World War II, we had 50% of gross world product. We had over half of world industrial production. The rest of the world had been a battleground. 50 million people had been killed. The major industrial powers, there were only four epicenters of industrial power in the world at that time. You know, Russia was ravaged. They lost, 20 million? Moscow was the edge of Moscow was a battleground. St. Petersburg was blown to pieces. Europe was ravaged. Japan was bombed beyond imagining. Only America was whole. So we had half the world's industrial production. We're now down to about 16-17% and falling. And China's rising fast. So by any measure, yes, our relative industrial power has gone down. There's no question about that. Our military power, greater than ever before, since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And there's a question of can America maintain this global reach, this extraordinary global power, when its share of the world economy falls, inevitably every single year. I mean, the U.S. National Intelligence Council has said, and this is the supreme analytic body, the consensus of opinion among the 16 U.S. intelligence agencies, they do, every few years, they do a 20-year prospective on the way his world is changing. And their last report is basically saying that we are now in the midst of an historic shift that since 1750, the epicenter of the world economy and world power has been in Europe and America. It's now shifting to Asia. And they have some very simple statistics to explain this. In the half century before Britain ascended to world power in the late 19th century, its share of world production went up 1% a year. In the decades before the U.S. ascended to world power after World War II, we went up 2% a year. China's going up at the rate of 5% a year. Its share of world production is going up 5% a year. That's never happened before in human history. It's rising faster, even with these fits and starts and hiccups that you're seeing in the Chinese economy, and some very real problems in this. I mean, you're growing at that rate is just, no society's ever done this before. There are all kinds of environmental, ecological, social strains as a society just rips itself from its rural roots and moves into cities and builds factories and projects power into the world stage. I mean, this is fast, really fast. And that's because the National Intelligence Council pointed out 5%, okay? That's never happened.
And again, I'm speaking with Alfred McCoy, who's a Tom Dispatch regular. He holds a Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and is the editor of Endless Empire, Spain's Retreat, Europe's Eclipse, America's Decline, and the author of Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State. And his forthcoming book on U.S. global power is Ending the American Empire. And of course, Donald Trump would say that China only understands strength. And you've just pointed out the paradox that we're losing compared to the extraordinary and unique position we had at the end of World War II, but being the last man standing on the globe. Now other competitors have risen up, in particular China, but we're spending more than what top 20 other, I think, nations combined on defense. So at what point does this get back to our original discussion about the republic versus the empire? I mean, I don't think we can ever have a kind of domestic health and life that we should have, the social democracy that's possible here in the United States, without cutting into the defense budget. And that is not necessarily likely. Trump wants to double down on it. Hillary is considered by many to be a hawk. So, we can't. I mean, we're the only major industrial power on the earth that has right-wing welfare.
There are, I think, two. This contradiction between empire abroad or global power abroad and democracy at home manifests in two ways. You've hit one of them. The contradiction between building up the military budget and necessarily beggaring both infrastructure development and social investments in education, health, housing, and the like. So, yeah, that's one, okay? The other is the contradiction that I talked about earlier between an aggressive economic strategy of globalization, of backing your multinational corporations to the hilt and giving them whatever they need to compete on the world stage. And that, of course, has domestic costs in the weakening of environmental law, the weakening of trade unions, and the hollowing out of middle-class American life, which, you know, since the 1950s really rested to a surprising degree on unions and the kind of environment that unions created in the workplace. That's almost over. All right. And so there are these dual contradictions. I think we need to go to step back and look at the overarching structure of this conflict between China and the United States. It's got two dimensions. Basically involves geopolitics. China's strategy, very simply, is two-part. One, they are investing $1 trillion in covering the vast empty spaces of the Eurasian landmass, so vast that it took Marco Polo in 1270 3 years to cross them. It took the Beijing to Paris auto race in 1907 60 days to drive it. It took a century later when they restaged that race, it took 36 days of continuous driving, I mean, to cross that. I mean, when I was a teenager, I could drive across America in 5 days, okay? Now it's even faster, okay? So, I mean, you know, a month of driving, so vast. And what China is doing is investing $1 trillion in turning this vast Eurasian landmass, in fact, three continents, Europe, Asia, and Africa, into a unified landmass, integrated by, first of all, the world's largest high-speed rail network. And China has built more high-speed rails than the rest of the world combined domestically. It's now proposing high-speed rail links and laying contracts for one from Beijing to Moscow. It's also building they already have operating what they call the Eurasian Land Bridge rail connections. They're shipping goods directly across the Eurasian landmass. But more importantly, They're building networks of oil and gas pipelines that bring Soviet oil and gas into China and bring the vast energy resources of Central Asia into China, integrating the Eurasian landmass. That's one part. So they'll have this vast continental empire, which, you know, going back to the imperial age, you know, going all the way back to the Golden Horde 1,000 years ago. I mean, the conflict between the great continental powers and the sea powers. And the other thing they're doing is that they are cutting through the circles of steel that the United States laid down at the end of World War II. A brilliant British imperial historian, John Darwin, argued that the U.S. global power, the unprecedented U.S. global power, arose from a simple and, I think, overlooked fact. The U.S. captured the axial points. Okay, became the first power in history to dominate the axial points of the Eurasian landmass at the end of World War II, Western Europe and Japan. That gave us, you know, control of these axial points. And then we linked those axial points by building this network of military alliances, fleets, the 6th Fleet, the 7th Fleet, then the 5th Fleet, that arced around the whole Eurasian landmass. Massive, 700 to 1,000 bases, most of them around this vast Eurasian landmass, these layers of air, land, and sea power and military alliances. And what China is doing now is surgically and strategically slicing through that. Now, everybody knows about the South China Sea, that they're building these 7 bases in the Spratlys. They're challenging on a regular basis U.S. naval patrols, and there's a real contest. The Pentagon just a few weeks ago said that by 2030, China's going to have enough aircraft carriers. Right now, they have just one, the Liaoning. But they'll have enough aircraft carriers so that the South China Sea will become what they call a Chinese lake, which means that our axial point of control at that point is going to be severed. But what most people don't pay attention to is that by 2007, China had spent $200 billion to transform a dusty fishing village at Gwadar, Pakistan, which 99.9% of humanity couldn't find with both hands on a map, into a major modern port right on the Arabian Sea, 300 sailing miles from the mouth of the Persian Gulf. In other words, they can slice through this. China's now ready to be in the Indian Ocean as well. And so they can, you know, integrate the Eurasian landmass, slice through the arcs. You know? America's got a countervailing strategy. And that strategy is two-part. One, there's military, which you can talk about. The other part is economic. And this is where the contradiction comes. Obama's strategy, and he's the only person in Washington that has this intuitive sense of geopolitics that other supposedly great American statesmen like Henry Kissinger utterly lack. Obama has it. All right, he's a Pacific president. He grew up in Hawaii, you know, listened to the sound of waves. He went to Indonesia. Americans are very insular. Obama's not. He understands the world, the shape of the world, the dynamics of the world. His idea is he's going to split the Eurasian landmass, which China's integrating this $1 trillion of infrastructure. He's going to split it through trade pacts, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and bring 40% of world trade, redirect it, you know, hollow out that world island by redirecting 40% of world trade to the United States. And then through the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, the other one he's pushing, he's going to take the European Union, which is still the world's largest economy, with about 16-17% of world trade, he's going to bring that towards America. And he's going to use these trade pacts. Well, of course, these trade pacts have within them some really, I speak from a, you know, moderate liberal perspective, have some very problematic aspects. First of all, they supersede U.S. courts. They have these tribunals of lawyers who are arbitrators paid for by the corporations that meet quietly, secretly, without judicial review and without the U.S. court system and make decisions about U.S. environmental laws, labor laws, okay? It's a fundamental abrogation of U.S. sovereignty and the U.S. legal system, and they empower these corporations in a way that's unimaginable, you know? They transcend the whole U.S. legal system, one of the key aspects, one of the key artifacts of American life. You know, they're really objectionable, but, you know, and they're going to cut into the quality of our life in countless ways in this country. Yet Obama is pushing it, and he's smart, and he's saying, you know, if we don't do this, you know, we're going to start losing in the global stage. So it's, again, this contradiction between power abroad and quality of life at home.
Well, recently, Henry Kissinger gave a keynote address at the U.S.-China trade gathering in Shanghai, where he expressed concerns that Xi Jinping's new sort of nativist, nationalist, and xenophobic bent, you know, after all, he came of age during the Red Guard period in China, and is certainly, and now he's just made himself commander-in-chief, and he's now wearing the uniform, et cetera, of the PLA. The warning that came from Kissinger was that if Xi Jinping's regime decide to use military Keynesianism to overcome their fluctuations in their economy at the moment, then obviously on our side that would be music to the ears of the American military-industrial complex. So you've laid out these two scenarios. One, we're building all these bases, whereas the Chinese are using, and I remember our last conversation was about Sir Halford Mackinder's thesis, where geography is destiny. So the idea that we're ringing them with steel with the U.S. Navy seems to be a bygone era, you know, going back to the dreadnoughts and nuclear weapons and this whole idea of bean counting that I remember I worked on the arms control during the U.S.-Soviet competition. It's you get down to sort of totems of power. The real power is economic, surely, isn't it?
Right.
So how smart is Obama in the sense he hasn't reduced the defense budget? And who can do that, frankly?
Actually, Obama has made a major strategic shift in the array of U.S. military power, okay? And he's, first of all, also, he's the only American politician, you know, in what, I guess a half century, maybe even more, who has a unified world vision that combines a bold economic strategy with real geopolitical military maneuvers. I mean, Obama's vision comes together. I gave you the first half, splitting the Eurasian mass with these two bold trade pacts are going to capture about 60%, nearly two-thirds of world trade if they go through, and to redirect them towards the United States. Much of that trade is already coming our way, but they're going to increase it and hold it through these pacts. The other half of it, Obama has presided over a radical transformation of the U.S. military posture. First of all, you know, he was the first politician to realize that the Middle East was a quagmire and that he had to get out. And that whereas for reasons of global stability and also U.S. domestic politics, he's got to have some special forces and some drones floating around, but he's going to get the troops out of there. And this is something he announced in his 2011 address to the Australian Parliament in Canberra, where he talked about, you know, America is an Asia-Pacific power, and this became known as the pivot to Asia. Right now, we have a full battalion of U.S. Marines based in Darwin. We've got littoral craft that are coming in there. Naval ships are being based there. Obama has rebuilt the U.S. position along the littoral of Asia to hold one of those two axial points for the control of the Eurasian landmass. U.S. military is building a massive base in Jeju Island in the Tsushima Straits between Korea and Japan. We just recently got the right to build 5 military installations inside Philippine bases, ending that 25-year breach, the lack of U.S. presence in the Philippines that ended when the U.S. pulled out from its massive bastion at Subic Bay in 1991. The Pentagon has announced that 60% of all U.S. naval and air power is going to be in Asia and Pacific. So that's a huge shift out of the quagmire in the Middle East. And he's arraying our military forces in Asia to maintain freedom of the seas, openness of navigation, and to make a correspondence between, you know, military steel protecting, if you will, the trade flows through the South China Sea across the Pacific to America. A real close correspondence, okay? Classic 19th century imperial design. You know, bases and merchantmen and battleships, except now they're aircraft carriers, okay? So he's doing that. The other thing is Obama has made a major shift. He's drawn down the size of the infantry. He's disinvested in the old heavy metal military. During his debate with Mitt Romney, he looked at Romney with utter disdain when Romney complained about the lack of U.S. capital ships. And he sort of said, you know, it's not battleships anymore, Mitt. You don't get it, you know? And no commentators got it either. And what they didn't understand is Obama in 2009 created the U.S. Cyber Command. He's the one that militarized, if you will, the Internet. In other words, all these cables that are beneath the sea. The NSA, we now know from Snowden's document, has sunk 180 probes into those cables and gives them a capacity for mass surveillance of basically any human being that's got any computer access or any wireless access anywhere in the world and to monitor world leaders. So it's a global surveillance regime of incredible power and penetration, rendering the old shoe leather espionage of spies meeting in dark alleys, dropping documents and all the rest of it under park benches. That's over. You know, we've got that. We've aced that one. The other thing he's done is he's militarized space. Okay, the X-37B, there are two of them. The last one went up and zipped around space, a cute little 29-foot sort of mini Challenger with a cargo bay that can hold missiles that'll knock out China's missiles. China is competing with us. Most people don't recognize that part of the apparatus of U.S. global power has been since 1967. We were the only nation on the planet that had a comprehensive telecommunication satellite system, all right? All of our seas, our command, control, and communication for the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Air Force is through satellite communication, okay? What turns a model airplane into a drone? That is the capacity to operate over the horizon, satellite, okay? We're the only ones that have got that, all right? Well, China, by 2020, is going to have its own satellite system. China, in 2007, shot a satellite, one of its own satellites out of the sky with a rocket. So the U.S. is getting ready to militarize space. We're fractionating our satellites. There are going to be components floating around up in space, backup components, so they can zap a component. We got a backup system. They can't just knock out our big one. Okay, so it's a comprehensive system that Obama's built. Okay, space drones and satellites in the sky, aircraft carriers on the sea, and then NSA surveillance in the fiber optic cables at the bottom of the ocean floor. And, you know, and we're squaring off against China and any other would-be power. And it complements his economic vision. You know, it's fundamental. Kissinger mm-hmm. couldn't understand that on his best day.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, and by the way, the Pentagon just did recently talk about the five, they call it the five dimensions, air, land, sea, space, and cyber.
Right.
But having worked on arms control during the Cold War, my sense is that it would be a massive tragedy if the United States and China went back into a kind of Cold War tit-for-tat aircraft carrier building spree, matching aircraft carrier for aircraft carrier and whatever. I mean, deterrence in the sense of a Cold War, you have a Cold War because you can't afford to have a hot war. But deterrence itself is open-ended. There's no such thing as enough deterrence. So it is a carte blanche for the military-industrial complex. And if we're going to wean ourselves, as we talked about earlier, in terms of improving the lives of the American people that have been downsized because of globalism and also because of the excessive spending on the military, that's out the window. So that's and I mentioned Kissinger's talking about military Keynesianism as the Chinese option. Is it possible that we're heading in that direction, that we could end up with another massive waste of time, energy, resources, and with the sword of Damocles, instead of it being the Soviet-American sword of Damocles, it would be the Chinese-American sword of Damocles?
Yeah, in the Cold War, I suppose the best analogy was our missile silos and our nuclear submarines and our strategic bomber fleets were simply a modern edition of the Egyptian pyramids. We were sort of entombing our economy in this massive defense architecture, although it had some technological benefits, it strained and stretched our technological capacities. It didn't relate to our economic infrastructure and our trade flows. And that was a problem for those who wanted to have a classic sort of Marxist analysis of U.S. empire. The connection, if you will, the causal connection between military expansion, military might, and economic interest wasn't quite there. It was a game that was played, as you would know very well from your experience with SALT, almost in its own terms, you know? The analogies are many, but they all involve elements of irrationality. You know, schoolyard boys eyeballing each other, you know, the pyramids, whatever, okay, but they're all non-rational metaphors. We're now in a very different age in which the correspondence between economic interest and military power is now very tight. Let's take the South China Sea, okay? Because the Chinese aren't just building bases to, you know, as a sort of a counter, like, you know, the Americans got a base, we're going to have a base, okay? You know, they're integrating that with their economic expansion. Chinese eat 80 pounds of fish a year per person. They've got maybe 1.4 billion people. Human beings do two things to survive, carbohydrate and protein. The South China Sea is the world's richest fishing ground, bar none. The mangrove swamps on the edge, the sort of shallow continental plate that extends out from Europe, these are the richest fishing ground. Think of the Grand Banks of Newfoundland, but larger, far larger and far richer. The Chinese have fished out the northern edge. They've got a fleet, according to UN, of 92,000 fishing trawlers that are integrated militarily with its navy. They're militia units of fishing ships, and they're pushing down into Philippine and Malaysian waters to get this protein. And so it's not only a battle for bases, it's a battle for protein. China's expansion to Central Asia, you know, it's got military aspects. They're moving forces into the West, but it's also integrated with their pipeline. So and the U.S., again, Obama is getting this neat convergence between, you know, the U.S. military posture in the Pacific and the Trans-Pacific partnership, the TPP. Okay, so that both sides have got this very clear convergence between economic and military power, and that's what's different from this age than the Cold War.
Well, Alfred McCoy, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Alfred McCoy, who's a Tom Dispatch regular. He holds a Harrington Chair of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and is the editor of Endless Empire, Spain's Retreat, Europe's Eclipse, America's Decline, and the author of Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State. And his forthcoming book on U.S. global power is Ending the American Empire. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Graham Fitzgibbon and Norman Stockwell. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.